Couple of things, someone to help with the course. Last month, people got to pay, so we have to pick those up. So please remember to pay both for your meals and for the cover charge. Dr. Alkeck over there will collect your money. And I'm going to bring him up here in a second. We're going to chat about what we're doing this summer. Philosopher's Jeopardy. Let's see that. Let's get that away. Dr. Alkeck, you want to talk about that before we talk about tonight's speech?
For those that have heard me say this before, it's going to be repetition for those who haven't. The Dallas Philosopher's Forum has had in the past a tradition of having a summer program, a summer event of some sort. And our board this year has come up with the bright idea of Philosopher's Jeopardy. And we're going to have three teams. One from Southern Methodist University, one from the University of Texas at Arlington, and one from University of Dallas. The teams will be philosophy students coached by a faculty member, and they're going to compete in a Jeopardy-style game show hosted by Dave Potter out here, and he's going to be asking the questions. And first, second, and third place winners will receive cash prizes from our organization as a donation to their philosophy department. So we are asking, there will be an admission charge, but that's probably not going to cover, that won't cover everything. So we are asking for sponsors, and we're going to have a little program, and on the back of the program will be a list of sponsors and contributors, and we're selling little spaces from $100 to $50 for a sponsor, and then if you just want your name listed, it's $20. So please, we're asking for some help with that, all right? So you can see me or one of the board members later.
Okay, great. Speaker tonight, Jacob Sullivan. He is a senior editor at Reason Magazine. I've been reading him for probably 10 or 15 years. Anybody else subscribe to Reason Magazine or now see the website? Great. Hey. He's also got two books. First book, Saying Yes, in Defense of Drug Use. The second book, For Your Own Good, The Anti-Smoking Crusade and the Tyranny of Public Health. He's got a weekly column. Creator Syndicate puts it out. It's carried by newspapers, the Wall Street Journal, New York Post, Chicago Sun-Times. He's also been in USA Today, New York Times, LA Times, San Francisco Chronicle, and Cigar Aficionado. How many of you have been published in Cigar Aficionado? Real. Please join me in welcoming Jacob Sullivan.
Do I need a mic?
Well, yeah, as a matter of fact.
Can you hear me?
Here, I'll tell you what, let's hook you up with a mic. I didn't even think about doing that, so I can get it. Get it over there. Turn that on, stick it in the pocket somewhere. Should be good to go.
Okay. Is that good? Okay. So I want to start out with, this won't exactly be Bible Jeopardy, but Bible quiz. Okay. So Noah, the prophet, is a big movie out here based on his life. He's known mainly for, of course, building the ark and saving humanity along with a bunch of other animals. Don't ask too much about how he managed to get them all on the ship, but I'll give you a hint. He didn't have to put the fish on the ship because they're okay in water, so that saved a lot of space. But who knows, what is the other really important accomplishment that Noah is known for? Anybody know?
Getting drunk?
Close. Yeah, he actually was said to have planted the first vineyard. And people don't talk about that quite as much as the building of the Ark and Saving Humanity, possibly because it was almost immediately followed by an embarrassing incident. According to Genesis, Noah drank the wine and became drunk, and he uncovered himself within his tent. And exhibitionism, of course, is not the only side effect of alcohol consumption that has been observed over the years. The rabbis used the story of Noah as a springboard, and they told this parable suggesting that the way people behave under the influence of alcohol is related to the amount they've consumed. When Noah came to plant the vineyard, they said, Satan took a lamb and slaughtered it beneath the vine. Then he took a lion and killed it, followed by a swine and a monkey. He spilled their blood in the vineyard. This signifies that before a man drinks wine, he is simple like a lamb who doesn't know anything. When a man drinks as is customary, he is bold like a lion, saying there is no one like him in the world. When a man drinks too much, he becomes like a swine, peeing on himself. And when he is drunk, he becomes like a monkey, standing and dancing and acting foolishly, and says inappropriate things in front of everyone, for he does not know what he is doing. Now, depending upon the sort of crowd you hang out with, some of this may ring true for you. Personally, I think the order is a little bit off. And my feeling is, once you're peeing on yourself, it's time to go home. That way you would never get to the monkey stage, if you follow my advice. Now, so there's some truth to this, but it clearly can't be just a matter of dose. Because different people react differently after drinking the same amount of alcohol. Different people in different situations behave differently. Or the same person in different situations behaves differently. If you tried to catalog all these responses to alcohol, you'd probably run out of animals pretty quickly. Just to give you a few examples. Some people find that alcohol stimulates their thinking. Other people find that it impairs their thinking. Some people find that it elevates their moods. Others find that it depresses their mood. It promotes social interaction, supposedly, but also somehow impairs social interaction, promotes isolation. It makes people talkative, makes people quiet. Promotes friendliness, promotes hostility. Calms people down, makes people violent. Promotes sex, impairs sex. So there's a great book. It was published back in 1969, where a psychologist named Craig McAndrew and an anthropologist named Robert Edgerton explored some of these contradictions. The book's called Drunken Comportment. And they said, with alcohol inside us, our comportment may change in any of a wondrously profuse variety of ways. How can the conventional understanding of alcohol qua disinhibitor, that is the idea that you're taking this drug that releases the true you, right? That's a commonly heard bit of wisdom, right? Conventional wisdom, that the alcohol reveals what's really inside you. How can the conventional understanding of alcohol qua disinhibitor possibly accommodate the fact that even within our own culture, people who have made their bodies alcohol differ so drastically both within and among themselves in their subsequent doings? How is it that the same man in the same bar drinking approximately the same amount of alcohol may, on three nights running, be, say, surly and belligerent on the first evening, the spirit of amiability on the second, and morose and withdrawn on the third? So they pointed out that the way people behave under the influence of alcohol, it varies between individuals in the same culture, it varies across situations in the same individual, over time in the same individual, across cultures, across situations in the same culture, over time in the same society. They looked at a wide variety of cultures in North America, South America, Africa, and Asia, and they found examples of tribes where people would get falling down drunk without any dramatic changes in demeanor. So they could barely walk, but they were otherwise behaving normally. And others where people would routinely get into bloody fistfights after drinking. Within the same society, people might drink in a ceremonial context, and they would be peaceful and friendly, But in a less structured environment, drinking exactly the same amount of alcohol, they would be raucous and violent, even though they're consuming the same amount. So what they concluded is that drunken comportment is essentially a learned affair. The way people comport themselves when drunk is determined not by alcohol's toxic assault upon the seat of moral judgment, conscience, or the like, but by what their society makes of and imparts to them concerning the state of drunkenness. Now, the psychiatrist Norman Zinberg was getting at something similar when he talked about drug, set, and setting. His idea was that the way that people behave under the influence of a drug or the effects that people attribute to a drug depend not just on the chemistry of that substance, but also on the set, which refers to sort of your inner state, your personality, your expectations, your emotions, and your setting, which includes the physical, social, and cultural environment. All of these three things interact. In other words, drugs do not cause behavior. How a person acts after taking a drug is determined by a complex interaction of variables, a process in which the user's beliefs and choices play a crucial role. So the idea of drug-induced behavior does not fit the facts very well, but it remains popular, especially when it comes to the war on drugs. According to what I call voodoo pharmacology, drugs take control of people and force them to sin. People under the influence of drugs do not have a will of their own. They perform as commanded by the chemical that has hijacked their bodies. Because drugs are so powerful, the context in which they're taken is irrelevant. It's reckless even to try them. Anyone who uses them can end up being used by them, so even experimenting with them is reckless. All use is abuse, leading typically, if not inevitably, to immoral behavior. And this is the way that prohibitionists typically will describe drug use, including marijuana use, as well as use of other drugs. And one example of an effect that is often attributed to drugs is sloth, which has often been linked to drinking, as in this 19th century illustration. But the thing about that is that when it comes to drinking, people recognize this is not the typical drinker, right? The guy passed out on the sidewalk in front of the bar, he is a drinker. There are drinkers like that, but that's not typical. But when it comes to illegal drugs, people often will make these unjustified generalizations and say that the clueless, shiftless pothead, for example, is a typical marijuana consumer. And this image of marijuana consumer even has a scientific-sounding name, which you've probably heard. In 1970, the head of Harvard University's health services told Congress, "I am very much concerned about what has come to be called amotivational syndrome. I am certain as I can be that when an individual becomes dependent upon marijuana, he becomes preoccupied with it. His attitude changes toward endorsement of values which he had not before. He tends to become very easily satisfied with what is immediately present, in such a way that he seems to be robbed of his ability to make appropriate choices." And a decade and a half later, the founding director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse declared that millions of young people are living as shadows of themselves, empty shells of what they could have and would have been without pot. So if you have watched any anti-drug propaganda in your time, you've probably seen portrayals of amotivational syndrome. One example that seemed to be playing on the TV all the time during a certain period of my life shows these two young men who are sitting around watching TV, one of them smoking a joint, passing the joint back and forth, and one of them starts making fun of these anti-drug commercials. So this is actually fairly sophisticated anti-drug propaganda, because it refers to anti-drug propaganda, right? And has a guy who is skeptical of it and is dismissing it, and he says, "We've been smoking for 15 years, and nothing has ever happened to me." And then we hear, and in fact, he said, I watched it again today, he says, "In fact, I think I'm exactly the same as I was 15 years ago." And then you hear his mother calling out to him to ask him if he's looked for a job today. At that point, the announcer says, "Marijuana can make nothing happen to you, too." This is a more recent example. It's a print ad sponsored by the Office of National Drug Control Policy. It shows this pot smoker who says to his dog, I'm not sure if you can make it out. The dog comes up to him wanting to be walked, and the guy says, can't you just walk yourself? And then the dog says, you disappoint me. Evidently, the dog is not stoned. And so I would guess that either this guy should stop smoking pot or get a less judgmental dog. But clearly some kind of action is required. So despite the continuing appeal of this image of amotivational syndrome, the idea that smoking pot makes people unproductive has never been substantiated. In their book, Marijuana Myths, Marijuana Facts, Lynn Zimmer and John Morgan deconstruct this along with many other misconceptions about marijuana. They say there's nothing in these data to suggest that marijuana reduces people's motivation to work, their employability, or their capacity to earn wages. Studies have consistently found that marijuana users earn wages similar to or higher than non-users. This is a report from the National Academy of Sciences, so that's a pretty reputable source. They were looking specifically at marijuana as a medicine, but in the process of doing that, they had to consider what are the possible side effects of this medicine, and so one of the things they looked at was amotivational syndrome. They said it is not a medical diagnosis, but it has been used to describe young people who drop out of social activities and show little interest in school, work, or other goal-directed activity. When heavy marijuana use accompanies these symptoms, the drug is often cited as the cause, but there is no convincing data to demonstrate a causal relationship between marijuana smoking and these behavioral characteristics. So this idea has been debunked over and over again, and in case you think that it has gone away, I would note that during the Super Bowl this year, when the Marijuana Policy Project sponsored an ad, actually a series of ads around the area of the arena, what's the name of the arena where it was held?
MetLife in New Jersey.
In New Jersey. It's a big
MetLife stadium.
Okay, stadium, big stadium. So they sponsored these outdoor ads. They're basically pushing marijuana reform. Some of them specifically criticized the NFL's policy on marijuana, saying it didn't make any sense. Apparently, a huge percentage of NFL players, smoke pot to relieve aches and pains and to relax in their downtime. And you can get disciplined for this. And they were arguing this was unfair. In response to this, a group called Project SAM, which may one day prove to be the last remaining anti-pot group in the country, started recently, but they got a lot of energy. So they sponsored an ad, and the main theme of it was that marijuana won't kill you, right? They weren't saying it won't kill you, you won't necessarily lead to heroin, but you'll never amount to anything if you smoke pot. So this idea is still being pushed, despite the fact that we've got lots of high achievers, so to speak, out there who are well known to have smoked pot, in the younger days at least, and it didn't stop them from achieving great things. So what's interesting about this meme is that it's actually repeating themes that were heard a long time ago, the turn of the 20th century, in connection with a different sort of cigarette. Long before pot smoking became popular among middle-class white adolescents, something that sounded very much like amotivational syndrome was blamed on tobacco cigarettes. This is, there was a 1904 textbook called Our Bodies and How We Live. This little book, I actually have a copy of it at home, which informed students that the honors of the great schools, academies, and colleges are very largely taken by the abstainers from tobacco. The reason for this is plain. The mind of the habitual user of tobacco is apt to lose its capacity for study or successful effort. And this cartoon comes from a book that Henry Ford put together, which was a collection of, I guess, the opposite of testimonials, a collection of warnings from various celebrities about how you should never mess with cigarettes. Here, Thomas Edison, who was another anti-cigarette campaigner, is testing the brain of this little boy who's smoking with a little voltmeter there, and I don't know if you can see, it registers zero. But this is what happens to you if you smoke tobacco. Baseball manager Connie Mack, who was also in Henry Ford's book, asserted that boys at the age of 10 to 15 who have continued smoking cigarettes do not, as a rule, amount to anything. They are unfit in every way for any kind of work where brains are needed. No boy or man can expect to succeed in this world through high position and continue the use of cigarettes. Here's a cartoon. This is from the Women's Christian Temperance Union, showing you the various things that can mess you up as you proceed down the river of life. And so one of them is bad company, and there's gambling, and there's alcohol, and of course, cigarettes. And then if you get through it all, you get to success at the end there. So this was not just a crack, I mean, it was a crackpot thing, but these were ideas were shared by a lot of well-known intellectuals. For example, the biologist David Starr Jordan, who was the first president of Stanford University, said, "The boy who smokes cigarettes need not be anxious about his future. He has none." So what you see here is that like marijuana, more recently, tobacco was said to strip young people of the ambition and ability to succeed in school and at work, undermining the conditions essential to prosperity. And I think these parallels suggest that what we're seeing is that there's certain anxieties that every generation has about the next generation coming up, and these drugs became symbols for those. So another danger that drugs are said to pose has to do with sex, lust, and that fear has been attached to a variety of drugs over the years, including alcohol, right? But when it comes to alcohol, again, it's not always, obviously you can get a woman drunk and rape her, that's pretty sinister, but in the context of alcohol, getting someone loosened up or loosening both of you up before sex is not necessarily seen as a crime or a scandal. And in fact, you know this quip from Ogden Nash, often seen in a sort of lighthearted way. Right? But when you're dealing with illegal drugs, even though it's the same sort of fear, people tend to find it scarier. So MDMA, which nowadays used to be called ecstasy, which was a stupid name, and nowadays it's called Molly, which is an even stupider name. But for years, it was portrayed as a precursor to reckless, regrettable sex at best, and sexual assault at worst. Here's a pediatrician who's claiming that ecstasy leads to 5,000 teenage assaults on teenage and young adult women every year. Back in 2001, the Chicago Tribune warned parents that wild rave parties lure youngsters into environments loaded with dangerous club drugs, underage drinking, and sometimes predatory sexual behavior. People pay to dance, do drugs, play loud music, and engage in random sex acts. And the beauty of it is that the random sex acts are included in the cover. There's no extra for that. So, now contrary to this idea, this is not a typical experience. Not to say that no one has sex under the influence of MDMA, but the strong connection implied by these press reports is inconsistent with the accounts of most users. In their book, Pursuit of Ecstasy, Marsha Rosenbaum and Jerome Beck conclude that the typical MDMA experience is more emotional and sensual than sexual. They quote a psychotherapist who says MDMA and sex do not go very well together. For most people, MDMA turns off the ability to function as a lover. It's called the love drug because it opens up the capacity to feel loving and affectionate and trusting. The MDMA users I interviewed took a similar view. A retired professor told me, "It's just wonderful to bring closeness, intimacy, not erotic intimacy at all, but a kind of spiritual intimacy, a loving relationship and openness to dialogue that nothing else can quite match." And this, of course, this sort of effect is what people were seeking when they used it in the context of psychotherapy, even before MDMA was banned back in the 80s. That was the main context in which it first took off before it became known as a party drug. MDMA is not by any means the only drug accused by its detractors of inspiring lust. A 19th century anti-tobacco polemicist warned that tobacco eating and deviltry are both one, because the fierce passions of many tobacco chewers as regards the other sex are immensely increased by the fires kindled in their systems and of course in their cerebellums by tobacco excitement. Which sounds like an ad for a cigarette, like in the 60s or 70s, tobacco excitement. Late 19th and early 20th centuries, you had similar sort of fears that were attached to opium, except in this case, it was the sinister Chinaman who was supposedly luring white women into his opium den, and he would there turn her into a concubine or a prostitute or a sex slave. The San Francisco authorities reported that police have found white women and Chinamen side by side under the effects of this drug, a humiliating sight to anyone who has anything left of manhood. So the opium den was a menace because it promoted intimate contact between white women and men of a foreign race. The saloon was a menace because it isolated men from the civilizing influence of women. And under these circumstances, men's aggressive instincts, primed by alcohol, had free rein. And nowadays, I think alcohol still has this reputation for making men violent, or at least for making some men violent in some circumstances. But again, this kind of charge is always much more frightening when it's leveled at a less familiar drug. Because we know that we don't necessarily become violent when we drink. We have lots of friends who don't necessarily become violent when they drink. We're much more familiar with it, and we know that even though there are some violent drunks, that's not typical. Not so with PCP. Less experience with that. So beginning in the 1970s, we started to hear these stories about PCP, which, by the way, is a tranquilizer. So it's a bit odd on the face of it that it acquired this reputation. It was said to cause, it would induce feelings of invulnerability, give its users superhuman strength, and cause bursts of vicious, irrational violence. Robert DuPont, who we heard before commenting on a motivational syndrome, called it a real terror of a drug. Time reported that angel dust has been linked to hundreds of murders, suicides, and accidental deaths. One example, a user in California walked into a house and he picked at random, killed the baby, and stabbed a pregnant woman in the stomach. Other stories describe the superhuman physical strength and tolerance to pain that PCP precipitates, requiring several police officers to subdue a single man. So these stories about the powers of PCP had a familiar ring to fans of horror movies based on speculative fiction, and of TV shows based on comic books. But they were taken quite seriously, and I don't know if you remember, during the Rodney King trial, two trials actually, the police officers who beat him, one of their main excuses or rationales was they thought he was under the influence of PCP. And they actually said, one of them described King as a monster with Hulk-like strength. That's what he's talking about, right there. That's the Hulk he's talking about. So was there any truth to these stories? Well, in 1988, the psychiatrist Martin Brecker did a review of 350 different journal articles, looking at PCP in humans. And he concluded that the assumption that PCP provokes violent behavior in humans with predictive regularity did not have any basis in fact. They did find, he and his colleagues found, that high doses of PCP can produce severe agitation and hyperactivity, coupled with cognitive disorganization, disorientation, hallucinations, and paranoia. Now, if you combine that with the drug's anesthetic effect, this was originally designed to be an anesthetic, which makes its users less sensitive to pain, you can start to see where these stories about these crazed, superhuman PCP users come from. But in their search in the literature, Brecker and his co-authors found only three documented cases in which people under the influence of PCP alone had committed acts of violence. Now that is the very minimum that you'd want to have in order to start to suggest that PCP actually causes violence. Right? You wanted them to be at least under the influence of it and not some other drug that might be contributing at the time. Only three cases like that, and we don't even know, what the causal role was in those cases. They also noted that between 1959 and 1965, PCP was tested as an anesthetic in humans, and it was given to hundreds of patients during these tests, and there was not a single case of violence that was reported. They concluded that PCP does not live up to its reputation as a violence-inducing drug. Science fiction fans were not the only ones who recognized the themes underlying the PCP stories. They were also familiar to drug policy historians. They knew that before marijuana acquired a reputation as a dropout drug that sapped people's motivation, rendering them lethargic and docile, it was feared as a killer drug that triggered mayhem and murder. A 1917 report from the U.S. Department of Agriculture quoted a police captain who said marijuana users become very violent. See if this jives with your experience. become very violent, especially when they become angry, and will attack an officer even if a gun is drawn. They seem to have no fear, are insensitive to pain, and display abnormal strength, so that it will take several men to handle one man. A lot of these recurrent stories about how many men it takes to handle one drug user, it could be seen as a plea for larger budgets and more personnel. Pretty cynical about it. Harry Anslinger, who was the first director of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, got a lot of mileage out of claims like these. A 1936 pamphlet from the Bureau warned that prolonged use of marijuana frequently develops a delirious rage which sometimes leads to high crimes such as assault and murder. Hence, marijuana has been called the killer drug. Marijuana sometimes gives man the lust to kill unreasonably and without motive. Many cases of assault, rape, robbery, and murder are traced to the use of marijuana. So you might think that this precedent would make people a little bit more cautious about accepting these stories concerning PCP and violence. But to the contrary, Robert DuPont, whom we've met before, director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, announced that everything people used to say about marijuana is true of angel dust. In other words, all the stories that told forth, that was bullshit, obviously. Now, this is true. And here's a more recent example of the killer drug theme, bath salts, which are not bath salts at all, but it's sort of a blanket term for quasi-legal stimulants that are sold as substitutes for meth or cocaine, ostensibly not for human consumption. Back in the summer of 2012, you may recall this story, major news outlets around the world accepted and propagated the idea that bath salts were responsible for a grisly attack in which one man chewed off most of another man's face on Miami's MacArthur Causeway. This was an international sensation. I mean, this was made headlines all around the world. It gave us headlines like, bath salts, this is a cautious headline, bath salts, drug alleged face chewer Rudy Eugene may have been on, play police and doctors, instead of being careful, they say alleged and may have been. And new bath salts zombie drug makes Americans eat each other. A little bit less cautious. That first headline is from CBS, whose Miami affiliate started this whole story by playing up a local police union's speculation based on nothing that this chemical, or didn't even really identify the chemical, but he alleged that bath salts must be what caused this cannibalistic aggression. And the latter headline, the one about the zombie drug, it comes from RT, which is, I think is great because their slogan is question more. So like marijuana and PCP, bath salts reportedly rendered people uncontrollable, giving them the strength of several men. Now how many men exactly was a matter of dispute. Now bear with me here because this is important. We have a quote from the police union official who started this whole story. He says, I took care of a 150-pound individual who you would have thought he was 250 pounds. So bath salts add 100 pounds, even more than a TV camera. He added that it took six security officers to restrain the individual. So six seemed like a strong contender because this same exact quote was attributed to another guy, a local emergency room physician. Apparently they're saying exactly the same thing somehow. But that was not the end of the matter, because the next day, the same emergency room physician, Paul Adams, told ABC News, it usually takes 4 to 5 people to control someone who appears in the emergency room after consuming bath salts. That same day, however, the Daily Beast quoted Adams as saying, to place someone safely in restraints, it's taken 7 security guards and 1 doctor. So now we're up to 8. That story also quoted Sergeant Javier Ortiz, who was the vice president of the local police union. He said, we just had a guy that took 7 police officers and 2 supervisors to restrain. That's 9. So I took a scientific approach. I averaged all these numbers. And so we can scientifically determine that it takes 6.4 men on average to restrain the typical bath salt 4 or 5 per patient. Charlie Dent, who's a Republican congressman from my home state, Pennsylvania, he jumped on the Miami zombie story like Rudy Eugene did on his poor victim, Ronald Popo. When they learn about this face-chewing situation in Florida, Deb told Roll Call in early June, hopefully that will change a few minds. What was he talking about? Well, he had introduced a bill to ban several of the chemicals that were known to be used in bath salts. And he hoped that this face-chewing situation would help put the bill over the top. And apparently he got his wish, because a few weeks later, Congress approved the Synthetic Drug Abuse Prevention Act of 2012, which banned two of the substances. There are many more, but it banned two of the substances, MDPV and mifedrone, that are used in bath salts. On that very same day the bill passed, we finally got the toxicological results back on Eugene. It turned out he had not consumed bath salts after all. So forget about that. So one obvious question raised by this theory of drug-induced sin is why people would continue to use substances that get them in trouble. I mean, you use a substance and it makes you chew off somebody's face, you know, you probably won't do it again. You get into a lot of trouble with that sort of thing, even if you're not shot to death in the process. So why do people continue to use these drugs if they're getting them into trouble? And that's where addiction enters the picture, right? So if you start to use the drug and then after a certain point, or perhaps immediately, you can't no longer help yourself, you are somehow compelled to continue taking it, then that helps explain how it's possible that people would keep using these things even though they lead to all these horrible outcomes. Now, the sociologist Harry Levine pointed out that the idea that drugs are inherently addicting was first systematically worked out for alcohol and then extended to other substances. Long before opium was popularly accepted as addicting, alcohol was so regarded. I don't know if I have this Courier and Ives print, which is pretty good enough. Okay. There's a great Courier and Ives print from the 19th century called The Drunkard's Progress, and it shows the process by which a single drink with a friend, which seems innocent enough, leads to higher and higher levels of consumption, culminating in poverty, disease, social isolation, desperation, crime, and suicide. And like the last panel, the guy's blowing his brains out. And this was presented as the typical result of drinking, right? So keep that in mind. You start to get an idea of where alcohol prohibition came from, if people really believe that. That template, which was developed in the context of alcohol, was applied to opiates in the early 20th century. As the psychologist Stan Peel notes, heroin came to be seen in American society as the nonpareil drug of addiction, as leading inescapably from even the most casual contact to an intractable dependence, withdrawal from which was traumatic and unthinkable for the addict. There's a 1996 book, is a history of opium, by the journalist Martin Booth, where he sums up the popular wisdom about opiate dependence and addiction in general. He says, addiction is the compulsive taking of drugs which have such a hold over the addict, he or she cannot stop using them without suffering severe symptoms and even death. Opiate dependence is as fundamental to an addict's existence as food and water, a physiochemical fact. An addict's body is chemically reliant upon its drug, for opiates actually alter the body's chemistry, so it cannot function properly without being periodically primed. A hunger for the drug forms when the quantity in the bloodstream falls below a certain level, failed to feed the body, and it deteriorates and may die from drug starvation. It's amazing this was written in 1996, now that I think about it, but it was. So in Booth's gloss, as in other popular portrayals, the potentially fatal agony withdrawal is the gun that heroin holds to the addict's head. These accounts greatly exaggerate both the severity and the importance of withdrawal symptoms. How do we know that? First of all, heroin addicts who abruptly stop using the drug, they will commonly report flu-like symptoms. If you have the flu, you know what that's like. It's not pleasant, but it won't kill you. Maybe chills, sweating, runny nose and eyes, muscular aches, stomach cramps, nausea, diarrhea, headaches. In fact, addicts who have developed tolerance, so they need larger doses to get the same effect, will frequently stop using or dial back their consumption on their own. They will often voluntarily undergo withdrawal, this supposedly fatal experience, so they can begin using heroin again at a lower level, which makes it much cheaper. Another sign that the fear of withdrawal symptoms is not the essence of addiction is the fact that heroin users commonly drift into and out of their habits over the years, going through periods of abstinence and returning to the drug long after any physical discomfort has faded away. A recent example of that would be Philip Seymour Hoffman. We also know that patients who take narcotic painkillers, even for extended periods of time, can stop using them when they no longer need them. They develop so-called physical dependence, like heroin addicts, and they will experience withdrawal symptoms if they abruptly stop taking the drugs. Typically, doctors will taper them off. But long-term studies that look at people who have taken drugs for extended periods of time, taken narcotics for extended periods of time, find that they rarely end up using them for non-medical purposes. So the popular view, I think, still lags behind and still tends to view withdrawal syndrome as unthinkable and horrific. But professionals who deal with drug abuse have abandoned the idea that tolerance and withdrawal are essential to addiction. Drugs that did not produce significant withdrawal symptoms, such as nicotine, cocaine, and amphetamines, are still considered addictive. Didn't used to be the case. When the Surgeon General first started talking about smoking and the nicotine habit, he said it was habit-forming, not addictive. There was thought to be a difference there, mainly focused around the question of physical dependence and withdrawal symptoms. Cocaine was said not to be really addictive. So clearly the withdrawal symptoms are not the essence of it. And in fact, if you look at the American Psychiatric Association's definition of, they don't call it addiction anymore, and they don't call it dependence anymore, they now call it substance use disorder. But to have it, you don't have to have tolerance or withdrawal in order to qualify for that diagnosis. In 1989, discussing physicians' reluctance to use narcotic painkillers, the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, Charles Schuster, confessed, "We've been so effective in warning the medical establishment and the public in general about the inappropriate use of opiates that we have endowed these drugs with a mysterious power to enslave that is overrated." Okay, so even if this is not a physical compulsion, where the way Martin Booth portrays it, where you take the drug, it takes over your body, it makes you continue to take it, maybe this is just such a great experience, such a wonderful experience that people want to do it over and over again, and so they do. Martin Booth tells us that everyone is a potential addict. Addiction can start with the very first dose, and with continued use, addiction is a certainty. Yet, if you look at the data on heroin use, it's pretty clear that this drug is neither irresistible nor inescapable. First of all, very few people use it at all. So even among illegal drugs, if you look at heroin versus marijuana is more than 60 times as popular. So you have about 4.6 million people in this country who've used heroin, according to data from the National Survey on Drug Use and Health. And there are some problems with the population sampling here, which I can get into later if you want. But you have this group of people, which is quite small compared to the population of people who've tried marijuana. 4.6 million have used heroin, but about 15% of those people who have used it in the last year. And about 7% have used it in the last month. And even if you've used it in the last month, it doesn't necessarily mean you're an addict. You could be using it monthly, you could be using it weekly. But certainly that would be a minimum requirement, a monthly use, to be considered to be an addict. So the vast majority of people never try it. Other people who try it, the vast majority are not addicted. Seems pretty clear from these data. Here's a study. I had to go back to 2002 for this because they stopped breaking it down by what they call daily use. But this is a survey of high school seniors. 1% of them said they'd used heroin in the previous year. About 0.1% had used it on 20 or more days in the previous month. That's what they tend to equate with daily use, even though it's not strictly speaking daily. So maybe 1 out of 10 of these heroin users could be considered addicts. And these are the past year users. Another interesting study about the addictive potential of heroin looked at Vietnam veterans. It was quite common, certainly much more common than it was in the United States, for people, soldiers in Vietnam, to use heroin. A lot of them became addicted to heroin in Vietnam. And when they came back, everybody was sure we'd have this huge upsurge in heroin addiction. But what happened in following this group of Vietnam veterans who had been addicted to heroin in Vietnam, they found that for the most part they gave it up. And it wasn't because they couldn't get it. In fact, a lot of them found it again in the U.S. and used it again a few times, but then stopped using it. A quarter of those who had used heroin in the previous 2 years had used it daily at some point. A quarter said they had felt dependent, and a quarter said heroin use had interfered with their lives. And these findings are especially remarkable because the sample was limited to people who had already been addicted. So half of them had used at least once after the return. And generally, they did not become addicted again. Now, because heroin has this reputation for being so powerful, no substance can be taken seriously as an addictive drug until it's compared to heroin. That's why Newsweek, when it sought to stir up alarm about crack cocaine in 1986, called it intensely addictive, a drug whose potential for social disruption and individual tragedy is comparable only to heroin. Having established crack as heroin's equal, Newsweek immediately announced that, in fact, it was worse. While a typical heroin addict shoots up once or twice a day, the article said, crack addicts need another hit within minutes. Newsweek also quoted the psychopharmacologist Arnold Washington, who claimed crack is the most addictive drug known to man, causing almost instantaneous addiction. And by the way, worth noting, in case you didn't know, crack is the active ingredient in crack is exactly the same as the active ingredient in cocaine hydrochloride. One is the smokable version, the other one is the snorable version. And so the idea that this would be so much more powerful a drug than the snorted form of the same drug is on the face of it not credible. And again, the evidence does not support this image of a drug that's inevitably addictive or even usually addictive. Of the 38 million or so Americans who have used cocaine in general, so including both forms, about 1.7 million, or 4%, have used it in the last month. And again, last month use is not equivalent to addiction, but it would be, you would think, a minimum requirement. The corresponding number for crack is about 5%, a little bit less. There was a survey in 1993 of young adults. Only 7% of past month cocaine users were taking the drug every day. 4% of the respondents had tried crack, 1% had used it in the last year, and 0.3% had used it in the last month. In other words, 93% of the people who had tried a drug is said to be instantly addictive were not using it even as often as once a month. The percentage using crack on 20 or more days in the previous month, which is what they call daily use, was so small it was not reported. So cocaine, whether it was snorted or smoked, was never as powerful as its press implied, but it immediately established this new standard for addiction. So when President Clinton wanted to scare people about methamphetamine, he warned that the drug could become the crack of the 90s. A physician quoted by the New York Times called meth the most malignant addictive drug known to mankind. A federal prosecutor said it was more addictive than crack. Now, the weird thing is, you might remember crack was said to be especially addictive because you had such a brief high and you had to keep taking it, unlike heroin, where you only had to take it a couple times a day. Meth was said to be even worse than crack because the high lasted so long. Once again, this government survey data do not support the image of an instantly, inevitably addictive drug. About 12 million Americans have tried methamphetamine, according to the survey. Less than 4% of those who have tried it have used it in the last month. Oh, it's not even, by the way, people will often say, oh, if the smoked form of methamphetamine is way more addictive than taking it orally, like, as in like the tablets that were very widely consumed up through the 1960s. So this is, you know, way more, this is nothing like those stimulants that were sold legally. But it's not clear. The data are inconsistent on that, whether people who use smoke methamphetamine are more likely to become heavy users than people who take it in oral form. There's certainly no clear difference between the two in terms of addictiveness. So methamphetamine's power was validated by reference to crack, while crack's power was validated by reference to heroin. Crack was said to be just as addictive as heroin, if not more so. Meth was like crack, only worse. And throughout this period, public health officials and anti-smoking activists were emphasizing that nicotine is more addictive than heroin. So even as heroin served as a model for addictiveness, its reputed power was implicitly downgraded. More recently, though, heroin has been making a comeback in the press, you may have noticed. A few years ago, the New Orleans Times-Picayune warned that heroin is more addictive than crack cocaine. So you watch the title of most addictive drug rotate from one substance to another, and you start to wonder how much the honor really means. Now, by some measures, nicotine is more addictive than heroin. So if what you're looking at is the percentage of people who use this who become regular users and the frequency with which they use it, nicotine, even today where it's harder to use because of various smoking restrictions, is going to look more addictive in that sense than heroin. But one of the reasons that people are more likely to consume nicotine throughout the day is that they can do that and still meet their responsibilities, take care of their kids, get to work on time. It doesn't interfere, except to the extent that they're forced to go outside, you know, to smoke their cigarettes. It doesn't interfere with their everyday function. Now, long-term health effects obviously can interfere with your functioning in a serious way. But in terms of the psychoactive effects of nicotine, they don't stop you from getting done what you need to do. So that's not usually what people think of in terms of when they think of addiction. They don't usually think of a drug that is very compatible with your life. And you can use it and you get along fine. Usually they think of something that's really seriously disrupting your life in a negative way. A drug's legal status can also affect addiction rates. If troubled or antisocial people are disproportionately attracted to drugs that are illegal, especially the most notorious ones, so that would include smoking crack or injecting heroin or smoking meth for that matter, you're going to get a misleading idea of how addictive the drug is. It will actually look more addictive under prohibition than it would in a legal market, because the people who tend to try it when it's illegal are the ones who are especially likely to become addicted. They're not a random sample of the general population. And then, you know, something similar may be true for modes of administration. I mentioned that it's not completely clear. It's commonly said that smoking is, you know, more addictive than taking something orally, and then injecting is more addictive still. But that's all, you know, tied up with the factors that influence who it is that uses those methods, right? So it's hard to control for pre-existing traits that make you more likely to use those modes of administration. Like other effects attributed to drugs, addiction hinges not just on the drug itself, but on the user's personality, values, tastes, expectations, and circumstances. A person who likes heroin's sedating effect won't necessarily like the intense stimulation provided by crack or crystal meth. A patient in pain or a soldier at war can use a strong narcotic for particular reasons and give it up without much trouble once those reasons no longer apply. A happy person can take or leave the same drug that a miserable person turns to every day. A person who uses a drug to excess during an especially troubled period of his life may find that he can use it in a controlled fashion later on as he matures. That's very common with alcohol, for example. So given all these differences, it makes little sense to talk about a drug's addictiveness as if it were a chemical property. So why is this important in terms of policy? The crucial role of context in understanding why drug users behave the way they do has important implications for drug policy, and in particular the war on drugs, drug prohibition. If it really were true that drugs force themselves on people and compel them to act antisocially, that would be a compelling rationale for prohibition, because then you would actually have these little chemical aggressors who are out there attacking people, kidnapping them, forcing them to do their will. Then you would have a war on drugs that really was a war on drugs. Not a war on people, but a war on drugs. It was aimed at stopping aggression against innocent people, which is an essential function of government. But if drugs do not really turn people into zombies, if users have a will of their own and can reasonably be expected to exercise self-control, the use of coercion becomes much harder to justify. Social and economic forces can be relied upon to encourage moderation and responsibility, and the role of the law can be limited to those situations where users are actually violating other people's rights. In other words, this argument about the currently illegal drugs begins to look more and more like the argument about alcohol, and in that case, the proponents of enforced abstinence were ultimately defeated by the advocates of true temperance. Thank you.
A couple minutes of Q&A.
Any cues?
I want to try to clarify something. It sounds like you're saying that when we hear these statements in the press, for example, as I've heard about 20 years ago, that nicotine makes smoking cigarettes four times as addictive as cocaine. It's not literally the case that there's some sort of controlled study where they have been able to determine that once somebody smokes cigarettes, that this is the rate at which they're stuck with it unless they have some sort of major rehab burden versus cocaine, where they, you know, something like that. But simply, they're looking at the incidence of it in the population where, you know, you've got this many people who, oh, I'm a pack of a smoker, I have to have it. Other guys, I'm a cocaine addict, I have to have it every day. And they're looking at those ratios of the number of people and other people. And even though one is completely illegal and you have to go through all the tubes to get it, that one is therefore, quote unquote, four times as addictive as the other. Is that what you're maintaining? Because, yeah, that would be a pretty distorted way to measure things.
Yeah, well, there, honestly, there's when people talk about relative addictiveness, they either are looking at patterns of use, typically as measured by surveys, or animal studies would be the other way to do it. So you could look at, but then they would, really couldn't say this applies to humans necessarily, but they could look at how rewarding are these different substances to lab rats or monkeys. And but I think it would not come out that way for nicotine versus cocaine in lab animals. I don't think the lab animals actually like nicotine very much. They like cocaine, they like Oreos a lot. Like Oreos as much as cocaine and heroin, apparently, which is an interesting issue there. But yes, I mean, I think when they talk about things being four times as addictive with respect to nicotine, they would have to be talking about patterns of use.
If I may present to clarify some definition. As a physician, we were taught physiologic difference between addiction and habituation. Habituation means that you have a habit of taking, let's say, a sleeping pill to sleep, and that you kind of, you know, you like to sleep and find it kind of hard to sleep without it. An addiction means when you stop the whatever substance, there is a withdrawal symptom, okay? And with nicotine, there is withdrawal symptoms. So it's addiction. Now,
can I but just...
Wait a minute. You simplistically compared all these things, alcohol, nicotine, all of these drugs, and they're not the same. There's apples and oranges. They do different things physiologically, neurophysiologically to the brain. And so you can't say everything is the same.
No. Okay. I'm not claiming everything is the same, but the distinction that you are urging was abandoned decades ago by people who study addiction. They no longer say, and what you're saying is basically you need physical dependence, otherwise it's not really addiction. The APA doesn't say that anymore. You know, addiction specialists do not say that.
I didn't say physical dependence.
Well,
I said that there are symptoms of withdrawal.
Okay. Usually usually people equate those two things. When they talk about physical dependence, they mean when you abruptly stop using, you have certain predictable symptoms, right?
Yes.
Okay. So the point I was trying to make is that those are that's no longer considered to be a requirement for addiction. I think with good reason, because people can become strongly attached to pretty much any source of pleasure, anything that gives them pleasure or relieves stress, can become the focus of an addiction. It doesn't mean they're all the same, but there's not the addictiveness of a substance lies in the relationship of the person to that substance or to an activity. It doesn't lie in the thing itself. So I may try heroin and not like it at all. Somebody else may love it, and that cannot be explained by the chemistry of heroin. Some people become addicted to gambling. Other people, most people, you know, who gamble, do not, you know, do it in a way that just seriously disrupts their lives. So the explanations for those things don't lie purely in the nature of the experience. They have to be explained in the context of that person's life and the reason why they're engaging in that activity, what it's doing for them, that sort of thing. And I think it's very misleading to say, here's some, you know, somebody is using something very heavily in such a way that is really seriously disrupting their lives. They're having a lot of trouble stopping it, but it's not really an addiction because we don't see predictable physical symptoms when they stop doing it. So I would disagree with that, I guess.
My wife and I were in Amsterdam a few years ago, and I've done some reading about this and went to the coffee shops where they sold the marijuana coffee on one side, and turned the manure bin into the pot on the other side. And I was reading that they used the money from the pot sales to, they applied it to programs to for heroin and cocaine addicts. And that seemed like that had worked very well. And so when I heard you talking at this talk today, it made me think, are you advocating that cocaine and heroin and methamphetamine and all these drugs should be legal and that they should be taxed? And if so, why? If not, why not?
Legal, yes. Taxed, I'm not so sure about. I start from the premise that people have a fundamental right to control their bodies and control what goes into them. The government should not be interfering with that except to the extent that people violate other people's rights. So I start from that moral premise. In addition, there are all kinds of, in practical terms, negative consequences that flow from attempts to try to control how people alter their consciousness. And in fact, make the drugs that I'm talking about here in many respects much more dangerous than they would otherwise be. And so are we better off having moved from a situation in the 40s and 50s and even into the 60s where methamphetamine and other amphetamines were widely available, easily available, commonly used? Yes, some people abused them, no doubt. Moving from that situation to one where people are making the substance in clandestine labs that tend to pollute and explode, and you don't know what they're producing exactly or what exactly you're consuming, where it's associated with all sorts of violence related to the black market, where you start to crack down, ridiculous crackdowns on every kind of precursor you can imagine, going into methamphetamine, you crack down on one, they go to another, so the reason you can't get enough allergy medication during allergy season anymore is because they're worried about meth labs. Meanwhile, that pushes the whole market to the murderous Mexican drug cartels. So you have all of these negative consequences, not to mention all the people who are thrown in prison. I mean, they have absurdly long prison sentences for meth now because of this alarm about it. I think one would be hard-pressed to argue that the way people are getting their stimulation now is better than the way they were getting it then. It would have been better not to have cracked down so much to give people a viable, legal, predictable way to get their speed, because people clearly, I don't know if they need speed, but they certainly desire it. And it has, it has many productive uses and uses that are life-enhancing as opposed to life-disrupting or life-destroying.
So kind of interesting, all of it combined. I want to take it a little bit step further, and hopefully that in looking at your bigger work, that you go there on the dialogue of things like psychedelics in terms of ayahuasca and psilocybin and ibogaine, etc., because there is another division that should happen in this dialogue, which is between plants and drugs. And the impact to a group like this that's philosophically inclined more than from a policy standpoint, the root cause of why people engage in experiences like that anyway in drugs. So what are the conscious, and is it really a war on consciousness, not war on drugs? So we can say, what is the philosophical reason that people seek those experiences? And should we look at the differences in the treatment and attitudes between drugs and plants?
I talk about a lot of this, and the reasons why people use drugs are some reasons more elevated than others, some more acceptable than others. And so you mentioned ayahuasca, which is a great example, because that is a drug that you actually can legally use in this country if you happen to be a member of the right religion. This was a Supreme Court case, unanimously decided, interpreting the Religious Freedom Restoration Act several years ago. And they said, there are these various South American groups that combine native rights with aspects of Christianity, use ayahuasca as their sacrament. And so there was an American offshoot. There are actually several, but there was one in particular that was involved in this case. And I won't try to pronounce it because it's Portuguese. Uneo do Vegetal, and then some other words as well. But you know, the crux of it was that under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, this was because this was a central right of their religion, the ordinary rules of drug prohibition did not apply to them. That they had a statutory exception. Now, previously, before the Supreme Court changed the way it approached these cases, that would have been a constitutional exception. But nowadays, it's a statutory exception. So I think that's, I have mixed feelings about that. I think it's good. It's certainly better that they'd be able to do that and not have to worry about getting arrested, that they'd be able to get ayahuasca. But at the same time, it's kind of troubling that the government gets in the position of assessing people's spiritual beliefs, deciding whether they really have a real religion or not, and if they have a real religion, then that licenses them to do things that other people are not allowed to do. What if somebody's an atheist and he wants to use ayahuasca for maybe reasons that amount to much the same, much the same purpose, but not couched as in terms of religion, he won't be allowed to do it. Now that's certainly not fair, and it's troubling that the government is in the position of picking and choosing among religions. And I will tell you, for example, they have never recognized a religion where pot is the sacrament, and they never will. And the reason for that is not, there's no logic to it, it's because pot is really popular. A lot of people like to smoke pot for non-religious purposes. They don't want to have to police that whole situation. Something like ayahuasca.
The fastest growing church in the country.
No, but Rastafarians have a good claim, and it seems to me at least as plausible as the claim of the people who use ayahuasca. But they've never been able to win, and that's really the reason, because the DEA will say, we're worried about diversion, and that's what they mean, is that this is a drug that a lot of people like. Ayahuasca, almost no one likes.
So their consciousness impacting, their boundary breaking, and I think that's the problem.
Well, they're not less worried about it if it's a drug that has unpredictable effects that are often troubling, especially if it makes you vomit. That's a big plus. If it's a drug that makes you vomit, you're much more likely to get permission to use it. So peyote is another good example. Peyote has a statutory exception going even further back than the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. But again, this is a drug that only a small group of people is interested in using, and there are certain inherent barriers, right, to what they would call abuse, I guess, misuse, to non-religious use of it, that you really have to be committed to the experience to try it. So all of that seems very arbitrary to me. And for sure, yes, you can say there are more elevated uses for psychedelics in particular, but I think fun is also important. And and psychedelics are fun. And if there's a way for you to have fun that doesn't hurt anyone else, and for that matter doesn't hurt you, but in fact improves your life, it's none of the government's business, right? So I'm a little bit reluctant to talk about medical use and spiritual uses, and thereby seem to concede that you need a special reason, you need special permission.
Well, you need to swing the vote.
Right. But at the same time, I'm very conscious. Look, in marijuana, medical marijuana for sure paved the way for broader legalization. So I'm conscious that in terms of the tactic, that actually worked. At the same time, it certainly was true there were a lot of seriously ill people, and this helped them. And there was no rational reason why they shouldn't be allowed access to it, right? So it's a complicated thing. My long-term goal is that everyone, any adult, should be allowed to use whatever substance they want for whatever reason they deem appropriate. And so I want to get the government out of the business of judging who gets, whose reason is good enough. But I will take whatever incremental progress we can make along the line.
I've got a question, Jake. Could you talk about the difference between young people, let's say 30 years and under, their viewpoint on that position that you just have, and 30 years and older?
Cognitive freedom in general, I'm not sure I've seen good polling data on that. For sure, in marijuana, the younger people are, the more likely they are to favor legalization. But in truth, with marijuana, it's only retirees, basically people born before World War II, where you have a majority of people who are against legalization. And all the younger generations, you have majorities who support legalization, and the majority gets bigger the younger you go. I mean, this is one of the reasons why the Republican Party is in trouble, because they persist in pushing pot prohibition to the point where they can't even let states go their own way. They're going to alienate a lot of the younger voters.
Susan B. Anthony said, when they were trying to get the right for women to vote, we're just going to have to wait for some old white men to die off.
Which I find ironic on that topic, because this is supposedly the generation that, perpetrated so much exploration in the 60s, and yet now they've gotten so stodgy. But I think that there is a misperception in that. Like, my parents are in their late 60s and early 70s, and they're far more broad-minded about it. And as we look at medical use for people with things like arthritis and stuff, I think people are becoming a little more open-minded about it. It's a shift.
Yeah, I think so.
There's a field called ethnobotany that you were talking about, which studies both the drug and the cultural practices surrounding it. And if you look at the way they take Igbo game down there in South America, it's tied into all the plants that you see and other plants they mix. And when they take it and get on it, they see certain plants come alive and start to walk and talk. And, peyote eater Indians, when they see the god, it peyote, if you believe Castaneda, let's say some of his stuff is right. It's incredible the variation in effects that are introduced simply by culture. When I was in college, took LSD, it was out of this world, is all I can explain. The things I saw and even wrote, so I have evidence. It's something I never have experienced since then. In the 80s, I was talking to some young kids that LSD had sort of come back, and they were talking about, they would say, eat a bunch of acid. Let's eat a bunch of acid when we get drunk. Just that term. So LSD was reduced to something that puts a little tint on your beer high. Man, did it come down from when I was But there are things that don't vary, and they're the physiological things, like the speed of onset, the half-life, is very important. You sort of glossed over it. That's why inhaling, smoking a drug is worse than snorting it, and that's worse than eating it and then injecting it. And so smoking crack is much different than cocaine. I don't think you can say it's the same chemical. The body, the brain has a natural half-life type reaction, and it's there in everything, including, you can get addicted to Rolaids or eye drops. It's a physical reaction to the speed of onset and the half-life. You're not addicted, your stomach is, or your eyes are, they get red. They get redder than they ever did, and that's a real mechanism. And so,
okay, quick question.
All right, well, Igbo game. Have you heard about that?
Yeah.
Amazing stuff. What can you tell me about it?
Well,
Chabernethia, Iboga.
Well, I don't know a lot about it, but I've heard many testimonials about it being a cure for addiction. That it precipitates an experience that leads people out of addiction. And, you know, there were studies with LSD and alcoholics back before LSD was banned. I think all of these substances, they can precipitate very powerful experiences, which can be negative or positive, depending on the context. In terms of the route of administration, yes, in terms of the immediacy with which you feel the effects, and also the amount of the active ingredient that actually gets to your brain, that differs for sure. I mean, just look at smoking pot versus eating pot, right? So for sure it makes a difference. I don't mean to say that it doesn't make a difference, but the active ingredient is the same when you, in terms of cocaine, smokable versus snortable. In terms of the percentage of people who become heavy users, it's about the same. Of course, you may have different populations of users, which can affect those results. But there's very little reason to believe that crack, smoking crack, is so much more powerful experience that, you know, it's 100 times worse than the snorted form, which is how, you know, federal law treated it until recently.
My question is about kind of the beginning of your presentation, where you're making references to how something like alcohol can give, you know, makes me tired, it makes me energized. So I'm just curious where your, maybe I missed it in the presentation, what your opinion is, and I don't know if it's based on research or just your experiences, where is that what you believe, that, you know, the drugs really have no impact on what we do, what we think, what we say, or can you keep that out for me a little bit?
Yeah, I don't mean to say they have no impact. What I mean to say is that their impact or their perceived impact depends upon things other than the drug, things in addition to the drug, right? So for sure, if you you know, if you take Adderall, the way that will make you feel is going to be different from if you take Vicodin. Right. It does different things to your body, and you can if I mix them up for you and don't show you what you take, you'll still be able to tell me what you took. Right. So there's no question the drug matters. But there's a tremendous amount of, context has a tremendous amount of influence. So the context includes you and all aspects of you, including your expectations, your values, your personality, and all that, your tastes and preferences, plus the environment. And, you know, those things can powerfully shape your experience. And not just the immediate effects of the intoxication, but also your likelihood of becoming addictive. Or maybe to phrase it in less controversial terms, your likelihood of using it in a way that is destructive, which is really what we're concerned about. I'll introduce this notion when I don't want to get too much into it, but if we talk about addiction in the way that it was talked about for, you know, thousands of years before, you know, we have the APA, it was a strong attachment to something. And it could be a strong attachment to something, so you could be addicted to good books, for example. And that might be an addiction that improved your life. You can have an addiction that is indifferent. You know, a lot of people are addicted to caffeine, for example, right? It's not a big deal. If you're addicted to, you know, a few cups every day, it's not going to seriously affect your health. You can always get it. You're not going to be strung out, you know. You don't have to go to a sketchy neighborhood to get it. You're not at risk of being arrested or being killed when you buy it. It's not a big deal. So that is an addiction that's not a big deal because it has certain functionality for people. It helps them in certain ways, makes them feel better, it helps them pay attention, whatever. And the downside isn't very big. So I think that's an example of an addiction that we don't really care very much about. Unless you're the New York Times trying to scare people on energy drinks or something. I think we need to separate out the strength of an attachment to something and then the consequences of that. Because you can be very strongly attached to something and it doesn't really have very many negative consequences at all, and it may unbalance and even improve your life. So
one of the drugs was to be shown to actually increase the likelihood of committing, maybe not so much like, you know, I was trained to seven men, but increase the likelihood of committing crimes for whatever purpose it is, to achieve more drug or whatever. Would that drug be more likely, in your opinion, to be regulated by the government, as opposed to, I think we can all say marijuana being the, like, caffeine example, where it's a little bit safer to say, this one's probably okay for the public to have versus...
Here, as a general rule, what I would say is that no drug that regularly has that kind of effect, if it really did, is ever going to have much of a market. I think that's a good rule of thumb. So anytime you hear about a fairly widely consumed drug that is leading people to do all kinds of crazy, destructive things, you have to question how typical these examples are, because why are people, you know, on one hand, it's hugely popular, everyone's using it, but it ruins your life and everybody dies, you know. So, you know, why would that happen, you have to ask. And in terms of, you know, causing violence, just be very skeptical of these claims, because they're not just the things I outlined, but if you look at what was called, you know, crack-related violence during the 80s, when you go and break those down and look at the actual murders, almost all of these are related to black market violence. It's not people under the influence of crack committing. It's the same kind of violence that we saw during alcohol prohibition, which was alcohol related, not in the sense that people were drunk when they committed the murders, but that it was related to the black market for alcohol. So I'd be very skeptical. And just one other example of that, which, because it shows the importance of cultural context, COT. You know, the way that it's consumed in Somalia and Yemen, you chew these leaves, and it's very similar in terms of you know, the social context to coffee or tea drinking and that kind of thing. But somehow, during the U.S. intervention in Somalia, there was this mini panic about COT and how it turned you into, turned people into psychotic mass murderers. And, you know, because you have these young, you know, teenage soldiers there with machine guns and doing all kinds of terrible things, no question about it. And they also happen to be chewing COT, because that's what everybody does there, right? So they attributed to, a drug that in their society is very much like coffee is in our society, all kinds of horrible, violent effects that are completely implausible once you actually look at the social context. So I would always be skeptical of those claims. Is it theoretically possible that there's a drug that, you know, it will precipitate violence in a large number of people? Yes, but I would say if there is such a drug, it's never going to be very popular.
Mostly dental problems.
Actually, that's, I mean, that's also a conflation of various other factors, depending on meth mouth. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that's, there is no direct, you know, cause and effect relationship between consuming methamphetamine and bad teeth. There are all kinds of habits that people who use a lot of meth, and especially get busted for using a lot of meth, tend to have that is not, that may not be good for their teeth, but it's not the meth itself. And how do we know this? Acid in what?
In meth. A current cheap meth is very acidic, and you smoke it, it dries out your mouth, which is bad.
Okay, but this mouth drying effect is seen also in over-the-counter, not over-the-counter, but prescription stimulants like Adderall, which are very widely consumed. You don't hear reports about horrible dental effects when people take Adderall.
The drying, it's the acid. Vaporous acid. The way they make it.
Okay, but it's possible there may be new dangers introduced by the black market process, but the methamphetamine itself does not cause, I mean, we know, because people consume this that substance and others very much like it very widely, and when they get a pharmaceutical supply, that the teeth do not rot. So it's not a direct effect of the stimulant.
We've run out of time. Thank you for coming to talk. Great, live.